is Duran et al., Golden Buddha Corp. et al. versus the United States. Mr. Swift, I see you reserved 1 minute for rebuttal. You can begin whenever you're ready.
May it please the court, my name is Robert Swift, and for 39 years I've been legal counsel for the class of almost 10,000 human rights victims who were abused during the regime of Ferdinand E. Marcos. My first point is that the forfeiture judgment obtained by the Philippines in 2009 lacked any in rem jurisdiction, which
was—
Can you
speak right up, Mr. Swift? You're a little hard to hear. Go ahead. Thank you. There you go. Thank you, Mr. Stewart.
Hi. Again, the forfeiture judgment lacked any basis for jurisdiction. There was no in personam jurisdiction, and the court so held. It relied on in rem jurisdiction on the basis that it had potential power over the race. But the undisputed facts in the case are that the Arelma funds were in custodia legis of the federal court in Hawaii.
Now, that would, your argument would basically do away with the substance of this 2467 rule, because invariably the enforcement effort is in another jurisdiction, and the race is in the other jurisdiction. So it doesn't have to be, if 2467 is to operate, you've got to have the substance of the forfeited funds seeking to be forfeited have to be elsewhere. Isn't that true, correct?
Well, the reality is that yes, in a forfeiture where you're trying to get recognition in the United States, the race is in the United States.
Right.
But the foreign court must still have a basis for jurisdiction that would be recognized under U.S. jurisprudence.
But in Philippine law, they had jurisdiction. And isn't it really the fact that this case doesn't begin until the department requests the forfeiture proceeding under 2467? You can't have a 2467 proceeding until that request is made. And so then the question is, we're talking about that particular action as opposed to the prior action in the Philippines.
Well,
I mean, this is argued through many of these points, this issue.
Your Honor, there are certain statutory defenses to recognition of the forfeiture action in the Philippines. And perhaps the most important is that the foreign court must have had a jurisdictional basis.
Well, but it's the foreign court's law that would decide that, wouldn't it?
Well, but a U.S. court is not bound by the conclusions of fact of the foreign court.
Only if wait a second, but it's the foreign law that decides. Philippine law decides whether the Philippine court had jurisdiction, doesn't it?
Not exactly, because every time there's a 2467 action, the U.S. court looks to see whether there's a factual basis for jurisdiction. And let's
right, but factual basis for jurisdiction under Philippine law.
Well, whether it's under Philippine or U.S. law,
it would be a little bit odd, would it not, that a U.S. court would apply U.S. law to Philippine facts to decide if a Philippine court had jurisdiction to decide if a Philippine judgment was legitimate?
To the contrary, 2467 is intended to have all the defenses applied pursuant to U.S. law.
Well, if the Attorney General has concerns, the Attorney General can reject the letter request. The Attorney General, and the Attorney General's discretion is fairly broad here. So, but I find it curious that we would impose a U.S. legal grid over examining foreign judgments and deciding if those foreign judgments are legitimate under foreign law.
Well, it may seem odd to you, but the fact of the matter is the statute itself says that, for example, there must be compliance with due process.
Well, that's fair, but that doesn't mean that means that that the court will decide whether there is some reason why you wouldn't do it. But the jurisdictional judgment, in fact, the presence of that concern even further supports the idea that you'd use the foreign law first to decide the foreign court had judgment under its own
Your Honor, to follow,
of, excuse me, under its own set of rules.
To follow your argument, you're
it's
arguing.
It's not an argument, it's a question, counsel. You're the one who's arguing.
What is the result of what you are articulating is that this court is being asked to recognize a fiction. A complete fiction, which everyone knows is not true. So you're being asked to recognize, oh, they have in rem jurisdiction because they have actual or constructive control of the race. The Ninth Circuit held in 2006 on bank that a Philippine judgment based on in rem jurisdiction as to the Aroma assets would not be enforceable in the United States. And they published that opinion. And that's also consistent with
these are funds that started out. The theory was that these are funds that started out in the Philippines and were stolen from Philippine citizens, right?
No, that's not the theory. The money came, and this is undisputed, from an account in Switzerland from a Marcos crony, and it was transferred to New York. There's no evidence this money was ever in the Philippines.
Okay. All right. Thank you. You have 1 minute in rebuttal. We'll hear from Mr. Robbins.
Clay Robbins, Your Honor, on behalf of the Rojas claimants. What I would like to do is just take my time and address the single issue that I think is underpinning the presence of my clients in this court, and that is one of standing.
Okay.
The record that we have presented shows that in January of 1971, a tranche of gold was found by Roger Rojas in the Philippines. He took a portion of that gold back to his home, where it was taken under force by soldiers at the direction of Ferdinand Marcos. It is that first taking of property that has been judicially recognized as being the first act of Ferdinand Marcos to take any property, whether it was public property or private property. And here, there's no question but that it was private property because under the law of the Philippines that we've addressed, once Mr. Rojas...
You understand, Mr. Robbins, to have standing, you'd have to show that those gold bars can be traced to the $2 million that were in the bank account. I don't understand where that link comes from. You have $10,000, right? The gold bars were worth $10,000.
Approximately $10,000 US,
so
yes.
How does that establish that the $2 million in the bank account is your client's money?
Well, let's bear in mind also that there is also the question of three handfuls of uncut diamonds, albeit that were not able to be valued. Nonetheless, there are value. And they were taken from my client.
Okay.
But
how are those diamonds linked to the bank?
That notwithstanding, the requiring strict tracing of a victim of a crime such as this is just unreasonable.
There's a big difference between strict tracing and no tracing. There's no tracing, right?
We have tracing by circumstantial evidence. We have tracing by virtue of the date upon which the treasure was taken, the date upon which the payment was made to Aroma, and there was only a single payment of $2 million in November of 1972. And we also have the finding of the Philippine Supreme Court that the Marcos family had no source of revenue as of the time of the taking of the treasure, other than that which they were receiving from their government salaries. So you have that information. And the fact that you have this crime that was committed, and you have the intent.
Given an adjudication of fact as to the tracing, though.
There was never tracing, Your Honor. I will admit to that.
Do you have an adjudication of fact? In other words, when you went, you have a judgment.
We do.
Fine. And does the judgment though doesn't determine that the money ended up in a Merrill Lynch account in Why?
It does not. The judgment wasn't meant and wasn't directed toward establishing that. The judgment was directed toward establishing Mr. Rojas' entitlement
to
the treasury.
So all you have, what you have is a judgment of liability between the Marcos estate and your client, well, your, the decedent and your client's, well, and his estate, right?
We are, it is an estate, yes. And
you're
it's also a business.
General judgment creditor.
Pardon me?
You're a general judgment creditor.
We are not a general judgment creditor under the circumstances of this case, Your Honor, because...
Well, wait a second. What court has said that the gold bars and the diamonds ended up being the $2 million that were deposited in the account?
No court
became,
has yet...
Wait, let me finish. That became the Merrill Lynch account.
No court has yet said
so
that.
So there is no judgment that confirms your argument.
There is not a judgment
there's
as the court...
There's a money judgment that you have, right?
There is a what judgment?
A money judgment that you have.
There is a money judgment based upon a determination that certain property was taken from my client,
okay,
and that property, our contention is, can circumstantially be connected and has been circumstantially connected to the Aroma account because there is no other source of that money except that which was taken from it. Pardon me?
How has it been circumstantially?
It's circumstantially presented there by virtue of the timing of when the gold was taken
it's
and when the deposit.
On your part.
Pardon me?
It's pure speculation.
It is not, Your Honor.
The
it is.
Amounts are different. Your particular the value of the treasure at that point is very, very low. This is money that comes into the Merrill Lynch account from Switzerland. There's no reason to think that you know that this is part of it, is it?
Well, at the very least, we have standing, even if it's a part of that which was used to invest in the Merrill Lynch account. There's no question about that. We don't need to show that all $2,000 came from the monies that were taken from the gold that was taken from Roger Rojas. But what we were able to show is that the timing between and the incentive of Marcos to get rid of that which he stole from Rojas leads inferentially, certainly, to the purchase of this asset.
Right.
There is no other showing, notwithstanding what the government has said, there is no evidence of the Marcos having any degree of wealth prior to the 1972 or 1971 taking from Roger's home.
All right, thank you. All right. Okay, we'll hear from the government.
Thank you.
Mr. Sahn.
May it please the court, Joshua Sohn for the United States. To address Duran's jurisdictional defense first, certainly the question of whether the Sandabagayan had jurisdiction must be measured under the rules of the Sandabagayan, the rules and the laws of the Philippines. And here, the Philippine Supreme Court, this is at Rojas Joint Appendix, page 109 through 112, expressly addressed this argument. And it said, no, the fact that the funds are in the United States, not under the direct control of the Philippine courts, does not affect jurisdiction. So this is an opinion from the highest court of the Philippines addressing the precise argument that counsel is now raising, and they are rejecting that argument. So we view that is the beginning and the end of the jurisdictional inquiry, when you have the highest court in the Philippines addressing this very argument, saying it does not deprive the court of jurisdiction.
Well, if you were to view this in a general way, the fact that this statute is invoked necessarily implies that the race is in a different country than the original judgment, doesn't it?
Yes, absolutely. So,
I mean, otherwise Congress, this statute would have no meaning, it seems to me.
Yes, and that's a practical reason why we feel Duran's argument simply
well,
makes
in a way,
no sense.
It's a confirmation by Congress. You don't have to show that the race is in the original country. They're assuming it isn't.
I would agree with that,
Your Honor. That's the basis upon which this statute was enacted.
I would agree with that, Your Honor.
I thought you would.
So unless the court has any other questions on the Duran jurisdictional defense, I would turn to the Rojas issues in the case. Here, as I think all the panel members recognize, there is zero tracing of the...
Well, there's timing. He's pointing to timing.
Even the timing...
Marcos cashes in, gets whatever cash he has, and then accumulates it with other assets that he has, and eventually it ends up in Switzerland and then the United States. That's essentially what they're arguing.
Well, so it's undisputed the vast majority of the Rojas treasure was not excavated until the mid-1970s. So all Rojas is left with is the $10,000 worth of gold bars and the diamonds that had no ascertainable or ascertained value whatsoever. And as for the timing, though, I think it's important to note, it's quite looser than Rojas seems to imply. The raid on Roger Rojas's house was April 1971. The Arelma deposit wasn't made until November 1972, so you're dealing with an 18-month gap. It's hardly like a bang-bang situation where you might be able to infer if these two things happen right after each other.
That I thought I heard Mr. Rodman say that there was a finding by a Philippine court that they had no other assets at the time of the deposit. Is that accurate or not?
No, Your Honor. What the Philippine court, what I believe counsel is referring to, is the Sandabagayan judgment, the judgment that was eventually, that really is the focus of this 2467 action, had to decide whether the Arelma deposit was Marcos's legitimate wealth or not. And what it held was, look, Marcos's legitimate wealth, the salary he drew as president, was way out of proportion to these $2 million. So we are going to infer that the $2 million was illegitimate wealth. And that's what rendered it forfeitable. But there was absolutely no finding that it came from Roger Rojas. Roger Rojas was not mentioned in the Sandabagayan.
There was no finding about how much illegitimate wealth he had at that point in terms of millions and millions of dollars, right? In bank accounts or elsewhere, right?
Right. All it held was that the assets in the case 141 in the Philippines, that the assets in case 141, the hundreds of millions of dollars at issue, were vastly, vastly disproportionate to Marcos's legitimate salaried wealth. And therefore, you can infer it's illicit wealth and is therefore forfeitable. But there was absolutely no finding it came from Roger Rojas. There was absolutely no finding it came from the treasure. The treasure was not mentioned in this Philippine case. So Rojas is just respectfully engaging in wishful thinking that you had these $10,000 worth of gold and these unascertained diamonds taken, and then 18 months later, Marcos, one of the most egregious kleptocrats in history, makes a $2 million deposit, and that the deposit stems from the theft 18 months earlier. And there's just no basis for that wishful inference. So unless the court has any other questions, I would reserve the rest of my time.
The problem with the Rojas is that if he had a judgment that had traced, had memorialized this, and in essence imposed a constructive trust on the assets, then he'd have standing to come before, because he truly would be affected. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes.
If it were this, because it's the same res, he's got a competing claim to the res, and he'd be in a position then where his property interest is fairly well defined.
I would agree with that, Your Honor.
But if we were to give the, I presume that you're concerned about the definition of effect finding that he fits within the term affected would produce many litigation opportunities for other general creditors, those who might not even yet have reduced their claims to judgment, saying, well, I've really got a claim against the Republic of X. And I ought to be able to, because if this forfeiture goes through, that's another asset that I won't be able to execute against when I get my judgment. So it expands it way beyond the concept of what one would see as kind of a concrete set of injuries.
I do agree with that, Your Honor.
All right. Lastly, as to Duran, Duran loses because?
Duran loses because Duran has not made out a cognizable defense under Section 2467 D1. All of the statutory defenses he's raised fail. The only one addressed thus far at this oral argument is the jurisdictional defense. But in the briefing, we laid out why he has not made out any defense.
And at one time he had a judgment in the interpleader that entitled him to this asset, did he not?
We're not disputing Duran's standing.
He had a judgment at one time, right?
Yes.
And he kind of hangs his head on that a bit. I'm anxious to see if he says something about a rebuttal. But that judgment doesn't exist anymore, does it?
No, that judgment was wiped out by the Supreme Court's 2008 Pimentel decision.
Took a little while for the district court judge to finally come around to what the Supreme Court wanted to do, but kind of a curious thing from a federal judge's perspective.
And the Supreme Court, I think, had some sharp words for the district court judge in that case. But certainly by the time the Sandabagayan ruled, the district judge actually had, albeit belatedly, recognized that Duran's judgment was wiped out by Pimentel.
All right. Thank you.
All right, thank you. All right, Mr. Swift, you have 1 minute in rebuttal.
I think the fundamental disagreement that I have with the position that was articulated is that while a district court is required to accept the factual findings of the foreign court, it is not required to accept the legal conclusions of the foreign court. And I think that's fundamental to the statute and its interpretation.
Okay.
Also, if you did that, you would be taking out the explicit defense that is set forth in the statute requiring jurisdiction. And my earlier point was, it's a total fiction that they had any control over the race, then or now. That's why they're here. So there was none. And certainly in...
But controls required under...
basis for jurisdiction then, if in the Philippines, or anywhere. If the race is always in a different country, I keep going back to this, then there would be no jurisdiction to start the case in a foreign jurisdiction under any set of circumstances.
My time is up. If I had more time, I would go into the lack of notice, which is rather fundamental and a clear violation.
Yeah. All right. Well, you should have covered that before. But all right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Robbins, you have 1 minute in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I come back to the requirement of tracing, and what I'm saying is strict tracing in a case such as this. There are courts within this circuit that have not just loosened the tracing requirement, but in some cases, when we're dealing with the Ponzi scheme, they've even eliminated. They haven't required tracing at all. And here, what we are arguing for is for the court to take the evidence that has been presented, albeit it is circumstantial, and taking the inferences from that evidence, accept that there was money available to Marcos, there was an incentive to get rid of that asset as quickly as possible, and there has been no showing anywhere of any large investments of any assets, legitimate or illegitimate, by Mr. Marcos at any time prior to 1972, at a time when the only large asset he had would have been that which came from at least the portion of the treasure, the one-time gold Buddha and the diamonds of Tesla.
I didn't see it in the papers. Is there any evidence of what happened to that portion of the treasure that we're talking about? Subsequently, sales, transfers, the Buddha sold, anything of that sort.
There is evidence of efforts of Marcos to sell millions of tons of gold on the open market through contracts called Remington contracts.
When?
That would have been in about 1975 to 1978. Mm-hmm. So it postdates this, and it postdates a period of time when Marcos had gone back to the cave and taken out tons and tons of gold that had been left there, which form the real substance of the wealth of Ferdinand Marcos.
So there's no evidence that there were any subsequent transactions with regard to this particular part of the wealth, of the treasure?
That is correct. We have no information about that.
All right, thank you to everyone. We'll reserve decision. Have a good day.
Thank you.